This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another, then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Rocket strikes two military bases hosting U.S. occupation forces in eastern Syria, injuring three American troopers. Tehran says it's reviewing Washington's response to its comments on an EU draft proposal for the revival of the nuclear deal and rejects rumors about the current content of the U.S. response. Plus, the lawyer of a Palestinian on a hunger strike for more than 160 days is in an Israeli jail, says he could die at any moment. Hello and welcome to World News. Thank you for joining us. Two military bases hosting U.S. occupation forces in the eastern Syrian province of Deir al-Zawar have come under rocket attacks. Syria's official Sana'a news agency quoted local sources as saying several rockets fell inside the two U.S. military bases located at Al-Omar and Conoco oil fields in the countryside of Deir al-Zawar. The sources said the attacks were followed by plumes of smoke rising from the bases, according to a U.S. military statement. Three U.S. service members suffered minor injuries. U.S. military aircraft conducted flights over the area of the attacks. The new attacks came after the U.S. military carried out airstrikes on eastern Syria on Tuesday, claiming it hit facilities used by Iran-linked fighters there. Iran has slammed the latest U.S. airstrikes as a breach of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Tehran has also denied U.S. military's claims that its targets were Iran-linked groups. Tehran has denied Saudi-owned Al Arabiya news channel's claims that the U.S. has rejected all conditions set by Iran in its comments on a European Union draft proposal. The EU draft aims to restore the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran's official IRNA news agency quoted an uninformed source as rejecting Al Arabiya's report as, quote, untrue. The source added that the Saudi channel has tried to justify the report by mixing its claims with certain phrases from the text of the JCPOA. An advisor to Iran's negotiating team in the JCPOA revival talks also denied Al Arabiya's report as completely false. Mohammad Marandi said Iran has just begun studying the US's response and will inform the EU coordinator afterwards. Earlier on Wednesday, Tehran said it has received Washington's response to its comments on the EU's draft proposal. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the country has started assessing US opinions and will deliver its final thoughts to the EU coordinator. The White House is said to have turned down a request from Prime Minister Yair Lapid for an emergency call with President Joe Biden, with Israeli media speculating that the rebuff could be linked to the ongoing negotiations over the Iran nuclear deal. Based on reports, Biden's office has said that the president cannot talk over the phone because he's on currently a vacation. Also, according to Israeli news outlets, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, will not be able to meet the Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin during his visit to Washington on Thursday because he will be out of town. Gantz said he is visiting the U.S. to convey the Tel Aviv regime's concerns about the Iran deal. The Israeli regime is seemingly ramping up anti-Iran efforts amid fresh hopes for the renewal of the 2015 deal. The agreement was thrown into limbo due to the U.S.'s withdrawal and the return of sanctions against Iran 4 years ago. When it comes to nuclear weapons, there is no justification in its possession, let alone its use. Yet, countries like the U.S. believe they are entitled to have them while dictating others not to have those weapons. Iran, meanwhile, has called for the complete elimination of nuclear weapons, especially in West Asia. The only obstacle in that regard is Israel, which refuses not only to disclose its stockpile, but doesn't even move towards its elimination.
Iran has once again raised the alarm bells over Israel's nuclear stockpile, saying the regime must destroy its nuclear weapons. The remarks were made by Iran's ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations, Majid Takht-Ravanchi. He also expressed concern over the lack of progress in the implementation of the 1995 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT resolution, and the 2010 Action Plan on the Middle East. NPT is a landmark international treaty whose objective is to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and weapons technology. In 1995, the NPT Review Conference adopted a resolution on the Middle East calling on states to take practical steps to make progress in the establishment of region free of weapons of mass destruction.
The countries that have nukes are not supporting nuclear disarmament. They aren't supporting the new treaty, which has been signed by many, many other countries in the United Nations, forbidding anyone to have nuclear weapons. So I don't know what the answer is, except that I think Iran is on the right side of history in this particular context.
Takht-Ravanchi also slammed double standards adopted by the United States with regards to Israel, saying the regime in Tel Aviv must join the NPT, quote, without precondition and further delay, and place all of its nuclear activities under the Comprehensive International Atomic Energy Agency safeguards. Iran says the move is essential in realizing the goal of universal adherence to the treaty in the Middle East and establishment of a nuclear weapon-free zone in the Middle East.
But Israel is very aggressive. The people there are very deluded. They think that somehow they can acquire control over much larger areas of the Middle East than they already have, instead of understanding that they're losing control of the area they have right now. And the United States uses Israel as sort of a base, an aircraft carrier bordering on the rest of the Middle East.
Given the fact that Israel is not a member state or a member of the NPT and does not allow any UN inspections of its nuclear facilities, it risks security issues such as contamination. For example, Israel's nuclear facilities poses a danger to the Palestinian territories and their environments. It has been cited that Israel buries its nuclear waste and hazardous material in the occupied West Bank.
Israel has pursued a policy of deliberate ambiguity with regards to its nuclear policy. But it's an open secret that the regime is the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in this region. Based on estimations, the regime is believed to possess 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal. Israel has, however, refused to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the NPT. But the regime has been emboldened by the support from the United States and European states. Washington and its allies have refused to press Israel to open up its nuclear arsenal to international inspections. Israel is the world's eighth largest nuclear power and initiated its nuclear program in 1952 with technological support from France and the US, the two countries most vocal about Iran's peaceful nuclear program. The regime's secret nuclear program was made known thanks to technician Mordechai Vanunu, who blew the lid off Pandora's box back in 1986.
As far as Israel goes, I think they're going to, you know, they're losing support of the global community rapidly through their behavior these days, because they've just gone so far outside of reality. Again, their behavior is so unacceptable, and their claims are so surreal that no one can buy them. And even here in the U.S., they're losing support because the people themselves are going, what can you say about, you know, a country that acts like this? There's no excuses left.
The regime's refusal to join international inspections and eliminate its nuclear stockpile comes amid its vehement opposition to Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. Tehran's nuclear activities have been under the full international inspections. Over the years, the regime has assassinated at least 7 Iranian nuclear scientists and conducted a series of sabotage operations against the Islamic Republic's nuclear facilities. The regime has also threatened to launch attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian's trip to Mali has ended, and he is now in Tanzania as part of his tour to the continent. During his stay in Africa, the top Iranian diplomat aims to explore potential expanding ties with two nations. Our correspondent Mati Abbasian has more in his report.
Iran's foreign minister's trip to Mali has come to an end. Amir Abdollahian and his Malian counterpart, Abdoulaye Diop, hailed their meeting as constructive, hoping that their negotiations would help develop bonds of friendship between the two nations.
We made an agreement with Mali's foreign minister and the head of the country's transitional government to take bigger steps in the coming months in various areas, including the activities of knowledge-based companies and transfer of technology in this field, as well as defense cooperation to help boost peace, stability, and security in this country.
Both sides are more dedicated than ever to taking the next steps to deepen ties.
The trip to Mali marked Amir Abdollahian's first visit to an African nation during his time in office as Iran's foreign minister. He then departed Bamako for his next destination, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania's largest city, an industrial hub which is home to the country's main port. Upon arrival at Dar es Salaam's international airport, Tanzanian Foreign Minister Liberata Mulamula warmly welcomed his Iranian counterpart.
We are delighted to have this high-level visit. And while he's here, I know His Excellency has only a few days, but we'd like him to see Tanzania and be able to visit Zanzibar and visit the capital. So we are really excited. We are also excited that he's coming with the business group. So we'll have a business forum. So we want also to thank the ambassador here for organizing this. So to you all, we say Karibu sana.
Amir Abdollahian, for his part, thanked his counterpart for hosting the top diplomat and his accompanying delegation, as well as governmental and private sector representatives.
There are lots of opportunities for developing Iran-Tanzania relations, particularly in the fields of mining and energy. Iran's top diplomat will take part in a business forum and also visit the country's top officials to explore potential for boosting bilateral cooperation. Mahdi Abbasian, Dar es Salaam.
Moving on to the plight of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, an inmate who has been on hunger strike for over 160 days in protest at his detention without charge could die at any moment. That's according to his lawyer. Khalil Awada's lawyer says his client has subsisted only on water since he started his hunger strike in March. Israeli forces arrested him last December and have since held him without charge or trial, a practice known as administrative detention. He Zaki is one of the Palestinian prisoners who have gone on a prolonged hunger strike in protest at Israel's so-called administrative detention policy. Human rights groups say the policy denies prisoners due process and is aimed at quashing opposition to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. The economic crisis in the Eurozone may only be getting started, with data showing a slowdown of recession-level proportions. For many, the question is not for how many seasons will the bloc be in recession, but for how many years. Ramin Mazahiri has more from Paris.
Evidence continues to mount that France and the Eurozone are facing a long period of recession. French economic output just contracted for the first time in 18 months, with Germany's business activity plunging even deeper. The decline in output and demand has almost too many causes to list. At 6 months into the unrest in Ukraine, Europe's energy import costs have now quadrupled. The costly conflict shows no sign of easing as Brussels has abandoned diplomatic efforts with Moscow. The current drought across the continent appears to be the worst in the last 500 years, hurting crop yields, sparking wildfires, and increasing pessimism. That's helped push the euro to its lowest level in 20 years. The euro is now worth less than the United States dollar.
There are obviously many crises which are causing major problems for Europe, and many are linked to what's going on in Ukraine. However, we should not forget the supply chain problems which began with the coronavirus pandemic, nor the European sovereign debt crisis.
Despite the increase in gloom, last month the European Central Bank decided to raise interest rates for the first time in 11 years. That makes borrowing even more costly for businesses and individuals and could spark mass layoffs, bankruptcies, and home foreclosures. The U.S. has hiked interest rates faster than in Europe, while indicating that more rate increases will arrive soon. Since the Great Recession began, Western central banks have aligned their policies, though they do not move in an exact lockstep. The cost of living crisis is expected to significantly worsen this winter. However, many say a negative outlook for the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc is more accurately described in years and not just seasons.
Inflation is something which could penalize the average person for 1, 2, or maybe even 3 years. So we are witnessing how the average French household is getting much, much poorer. Senior citizens are especially being hurt, and this will have major political consequences in France.
Analysts say a possible solution to Europe's energy crisis is to implement the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. However, both Washington and Tel Aviv continue to hinder Europe's ability to protect its own economic interests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thanks for joining us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
On Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Records show the U.S. government has retrieved highly sensitive materials from former President Donald Trump on 3 separate occasions. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled, "Trump's Stash Retrieved from Mar-a-Lago Runs to Hundreds of Classified Files." Former U.S. President Donald Trump has turned over to the government hundreds of documents marked as classified and improperly retained at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, according to a review conducted by the National Archives, the custodian of presidential records, and sources familiar with the matter. The U.S. government has retrieved highly sensitive materials on 3 separate occasions. One set of documents facilitated by the National Archives in January, one set went to the Justice Department in June, and another set was seized by the FBI in a search of Mar-a-Lago 2 weeks ago. An inventory of materials in that initial transfer showed the National Archives recovered from Trump more than 100 documents marked as classified, more than 700 pages in total, and some with special access program markings that designate the highest level of classification. The disclosures, which came in a letter published by one of Donald Trump's liaisons with the National Archives on Tuesday, provides for the first time an official accounting of the volume and the sensitivity of the documents hoarded by the former president since the end of his administration. And it helps to explain why the Justice Department opened a national security investigation into the unauthorized retention of government secrets by Donald Trump that resulted in FBI agents executing a search warrant at his residence at Mar-a-Lago in Florida to recover any remaining official records. The volume and sensitivity of the documents recovered by the National Archives in January also sheds light on the Justice Department's urgency to make repeated visits to the pay-for membership resort and the push to have the FBI gather the materials after months of delay. Donald Trump has pushed back at the FBI and on Monday, 22nd of August, his lawyers filed a motion seeking the appointment of a so-called special master to determine what seized materials can be used in a potential prosecution on the basis of executive and other privilege, instead of Justice Department filter teams. The motion also asked for a more detailed receipt of what was seized and, as The Guardian earlier reported on Saturday, that a court restricts the Justice Department from reviewing any more of the seized documents until a special master, usually a retired lawyer or a retired judge, is appointed. If the documents are determined to be covered by executive privilege, then while Donald Trump might not be entitled to keep them, they should reside at the National Archives. Trump could have a valid argument that the government cannot use it against him in a prosecution. The argument, according to several former U.S. attorneys, is that the Justice Department should not be able to use in a prosecution any documents that are privileged, but are not subject to the crime fraud exception, which concerns materials which have to do with or is in furtherance of a crime. In essence, the argument goes, there could be materials or communications seized by the FBI that are privileged but not themselves be used in furtherance of a crime. That even if the Justice Department would like to use in a prosecution should be excluded from the evidence. According to reporting by The Guardian and others, shortly after opening the investigation, the Justice Department grew concerned that there might be additional classified materials being retained at Mar-a-Lago that they needed to collect, according to sources briefed on the matter. The Justice Department interviewed a number of witnesses and in May issued a subpoena for remaining classified documents. The following month, Jay Bratt, the chief of the counterintelligence section of the agency, and three other officials went to Florida to retrieve the materials. At the June visit, one of Donald Trump's attorneys, Evan Corcoran, sifted through boxes of documents brought from the White House and stacked in a storage area at Mar-a-Lago to identify responsive documents and drafted a statement attesting to what they were giving over to Jay Bratt. The statement was signed by the custodian of records. The custodian is understood to be another Trump lawyer, Christina Bobb. Though a person close to Donald Trump declined to confirm or deny whether she was the custodian. But the Justice Department then came across evidence that Donald Trump might be holding on to additional classified documents, including in his office at Mar-a-Lago, the former president's principal residence during the winter until mid-July, when he decamps to his New Jersey golf course. The Justice Department were also alarmed that after it subpoenaed the Trump Organization, which runs the Mar-a-Lago property, on 22nd of June, for security camera footage, including of the hallway directly outside of the storage area, it showed people taking boxes in and out of the area. It was not clear whether the boxes seen on the security camera tape were related to presidential or government records. The New York Times reported that the Justice Department is now also seeking footage from the weeks leading up to the FBI search conducted on Monday, 8th of August. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's rival and fellow Republican, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, joined in on attacking the FBI for searching the former president's Mar-a-Lago resort. Ron DeSantis also released an advertisement attacking the news media.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
Part 2.
Big dreams burn down in these flames. The dreams of a young man who wanted to conquer the world with petrodollars and an iron fist. On June 21st, 2017, international media reported that a silent coup was underway in the corridors of power in Riyadh. King Salman, the ailing Saudi monarch, deposed Mohammed bin Nayef, the crown prince, and his nephew, and replaced him with his own son, Mohammed bin Salman. But for many, it wasn't news. On January 10th, 2016, The Independent had published an article from Germany's intelligence agency that said they expected King Salman to officially introduce bin Salman as his successor and delegate power. At that time, almost 10 months had passed since the Saudi aggression on Yemen. During the 10 months, the horrifying aspects of the humanitarian crisis came to light. On June 14, 2015, 2 months after the war, the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs reported the spread of dengue fever in Yemen and the deaths of 113 people. Only a few weeks later, on July 1st, the UN described Yemen as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Over 80% of the people needed immediate food and medical aid. The country is just one step away from famine. By besieging Yemen, bin Salman wanted to check the strength of the Ansarullah and Houthi forces and also trigger a popular uprising against the Ansarullah by cutting food supplies. Since the Saudi pilots weren't skillful enough, Saudi bombs would constantly target children, women, schools, and wedding ceremonies. Human Rights Watch reported that 309 civilians were killed in airstrikes until August 30, 2015, less than 6 months since the war. What did Mohammed bin Salman want with this poor nation that's on the verge of famine? How would he benefit from the lethal and bloody airstrikes? Some believe that he had his big dream, the dream of turning Saudi Arabia into the biggest power in the region and turning himself into the most powerful man in West Asia. But his dream faced a big hurdle. Iran, a country that's naturally been the heavyweight in the region for centuries. The Saudis accused Iran of intervention in Yemen and seek to introduce Ansarullah as evidence of Iran's influence in the region. It seems history is repeating itself. The story of Iran in Yemen has started once again. Mohammed bin Salman received intelligence reports that Yemenis are making missiles, but the young crown prince was so confident about the super modern weapons purchase from the United States that he isn't worried about threats by the impoverished Yemen, especially now that he's managed to win support from various countries. For example, he sought approval from neighbors of Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan for the Saudi invasion of Yemen. Among the Western countries, France, the UK, the US, and Canada all supported Saudi aggression. Among Islamic countries, Bangladesh, the Palestinian Authority, and even the Gaza Strip lent support for the Saudi raid. The support was the outcome of Mohammed bin Salman's diplomatic, political, and economic influence. However, Iran, along with Russia, Iraq, Syria, and the European Union, formed the opposition front. Oman didn't join the Saudi-led coalition and adopted a neutral stance. Indonesia, with the largest Muslim population, and China, with the largest population on the planet, didn't support the Saudi invasion either. Iran had adopted and active diplomacy to defend the national will of Yemenis. The other side of the war was the public opinion. Mohammed bin Salman wanted to depict a young and future-minded image of himself, a man who's come to reform his country. But his record in Yemen didn't help him portray the image. Even worse, two other developments made the dark side of his character more prominent. In the fall in 2017, another soft coup landed bin Salman in a secure place in the pyramid of power in Saudi Arabia. The incident is called the 2017 Purge. About 200 Saudi princes and businessmen were arrested and detained in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. According to news from Riyadh, Prince Walid bin Talal, a major Citibank and Twitter stockholder who's a known figure in English-speaking countries, was among the detainees. At that time, the New York Times carried a report on November 8th that the detention campaign was the latest move by the Crown Prince to grab power. Next year, some other news tarnished bin Salman's image all across the world.
If Saudi Arabia waited for Mr. Obama to approve an intervention in Yemen, Yemen would have been gone and lost long time ago.
A Saudi journalist named Jamal Khashoggi, after entering the Saudi consulate in Turkey's Istanbul, never came out and disappeared forever. The speculations and comments by Turkish officials said that he was killed. Khashoggi was one of the critics of bin Salman, but no one thought that the young crown prince would murder a journalist in such a gruesome manner without leaving a trace. The consequences of the incident were so harsh that even the U.S. Senate was forced to show a reaction. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee suspended selling arms to Saudi Arabia. The administration of Donald Trump had just taken the helm and had promised to boost job creation, didn't take the suspension seriously. In famous images, Donald Trump talks about selling arms to Saudi Arabia, and Mohammed bin Salman, who's sitting right next to him, seems to be very happy to be in this new situation.
But if you look in terms of dollars, $3 billion, $533 million, $525 million, that's peanuts for you. Should have increased it.
For bin Salman, Trump's coming to power meant purchasing more weapons. It meant public opinion had less effect on Trump. Without mincing his words, Trump said that he would continue selling arms to Saudi Arabia even after the Khashoggi murder. At the same time, the pressure on Tehran increased. The West accused Iran of sending weapons to Yemen, but Iran also had something to say. April 23, 2018, bombing a wedding ceremony in Yemen by Saudi fighter jets. The casualties were put at about 50. The bride was also one of the fatalities. It wasn't only Iran that felt the danger by Saudi Arabia. Qatar also cut off political ties with the Saudis for a while. Saudi Arabia had accused Doha of supporting terrorism. Even before that, in 1992, Saudi forces launched an attack on Qatar's border and killed two border guards and arrested another.
وفي البحرين أيضا قامت السعودية بإرسال قواتها العسكرية.
As for Bahrain, Saudi Arabia had deployed its forces to the country to suppress an uprising in that country. The Bahraini people protested Saudi policies.
أما الإمارات فكانت هي تسعى.
The UAE, that's after business in the region, pursue goals that are different from Saudi Arabia's. Those policies cause rifts among the Houthi opposition forces. Now, they had to pay all of the costs for the Saudi war. This was what Iran had pointed out time and again. During this period, Abdulmalik al-Houthi was keeping a close eye on the developments. The media noticed that he looked very differently. This is not the Abdulmalik during the first days. He's become thinner and emaciated, just like other people in Yemen who are struggling with food shortages. His thin face shows a leader who shares his people's pain and suffering. Abdulmalik had 8 brothers and he's younger than all of them. In terms of his personality, he's the polar opposite to Mohammed bin Salman. He's from a poor country and wants to defend his people against other Arab countries. These days, he's thinking of military strategies to deal a strike to Saudi Arabia, some strategies to cause concern for his enemy in Riyadh. The winter in 2015, when Ansarallah took control of the capital Sana'a, the Houthis recognized the Yemeni army's missiles, arsenal, and took possession of all of them. Different missiles were found in the arsenal, ground-to-ground short-range missiles that have a range of 120 kilometers and ground-to-ground medium-range missiles that have a range of 320 kilometers, in addition to 800 Russian Scud-B missiles. But in addition to all of them, Yemen has some missiles that can hit targets as far as 1,000 kilometers away and can easily target the Saudi capital, Riyadh. The West says Iran gave them the missiles. But what's the story? After the fall of Saddam Hussein, the Ba'ath Party was dismantled. However, Ba'ath military personnel went to different Arab countries. Then, Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh hired 200 Iraqi military experts. They formed the body of Yemen's missile system with Iraq's experience and Russian missile systems in Iraq. The Chinese were also involved. On Tuesday, October 4th, 2016, when the U.S. announced that it was going to send 3 warships to the southern shores of Yemen, in fact, it was in response to Ansarallah's attack on an Emirati warship. The attack was carried out with a Chinese anti-tanker C-802 missile. The attack meant that the Ansarallah was now in control of Yemen's territorial waters as well. But the Ansarallah didn't just have missiles in its stockpile. Military drones are another part of the Ansarallah's equipment to fight Saudi Arabia. To track down the threat, Saudi Arabia uses ground-to-air Patriot missiles made by the U.S. that's scheduled to block any ground-to-ground missiles or drones. They're supposed to down the drones or to destroy them mid-air.
Thank you.
Yet the Patriot system has failed to counter Yemeni missiles on numerous occasions. Sometimes it's managed to track the Yemeni missiles, and other times fail to track them. On Saturday, September 14, 2019, the Ansarullah prepared to target Aramco oil facility in a major drone strike. Bukayak, in east of Saudi Arabia, is one of the centers of the Aramco state oil company. The Bukayak facilities prepare crude oil for shipment on super tankers. In order to transfer oil to other parts of the world in tankers, sulfide hydrogen has to be removed from it. Bukayak has the biggest facilities in the world for that purpose. Geographically, Bukayak is located in the east of Saudi Arabia, near Bahrain and Qatar and the Persian Gulf. Ansarullah drones have to cross a famous desert to reach Saudi Arabia. It's a vast desert that comprises a large part of Saudi Arabia. No village exists there, and no human beings live there either. It means this is the best and most secure option for an attack. Drones are the most inexpensive type of airstrikes, and all countries are in possession of them. Ansarullah has many drones for its operations, probably over 20 of them. The drones were equipped with missiles and flew in two groups. The first group reached above the facilities at 4 o'clock. The anti-missile systems were activated and started shooting, but they failed to down the drones. In the first wave, the storage facilities were set afire. After the first wave, firefighters were deployed to the site to douse the blaze. All of a sudden, the second wave of drone attacks started. The second group of Yemeni drones was above the stores. In the early hours, Bin Salman got the news and became agitated. This is a nightmare that Abdulmalik Houthi staged for Bin Salman. Soon, we received news that Bukayak was hit in the second wave of drone attacks. His big dreams are burning down in these flames. We don't know what the two rivals, Mohammed bin Salman and Abdulmalik Houthi, had in mind. But after sunrise, the massive aftermath of the attack came to light. 5% of the oil production in the world was lost, about half of Saudi Arabia's oil. And it happened exactly when the oil was supposed to be loaded into the tankers. The Houthis knew very well where they had targeted. The bigger target wasn't oil, but a feeling of insecurity for the Saudi officials and the image and position Saudi Arabia considered for itself as leader of the military coalition in the Yemen war. But it seemed that bin Salman was more cautious than angry. No crushing response to the Houthis. What would happen if the Houthis answered the Saudi reaction with a bigger attack? The Patriot missile system has failed to help Saudi Arabia so far, but if the Houthis are accused of the attack, that means that Saudi Arabia has conceded defeat.
It was an affront to international law, and those responsible should be held accountable for their actions.
After 5 years of war, now Abdul Malik al-Houthi has the upper hand. It was unacceptable for Mohammed bin Salman. So, unofficial sources, news agencies, and some Western countries are pointing the finger at Tehran.
If the Iranian regime and the IRGC, they are trying to hide any evidence from the component and with the technology, they are mistaken.
Whenever the Houthis gain a military achievement, Iran is accused. But is it Yemen strategic for Iran? Is a horizon on the Red Sea and Indian Ocean and Bab al-Mandab Strait strategically insignificant for Iran? Maybe. Maybe centuries ago, during the Sassanid era, Yemen had strategic importance for Iran, but today the equation has changed. Unlike the past, Iran does not need to be present in a sensitive strait like Bab al-Mandab. The Iranian people know full well what the best strategic weapon is: friendship with the people in other countries. If we view Iran's strategy in that light, the support for the Yemeni people who started the revolution and were attacked by the Saudis will be Iran's best strategic asset. An asset that threatens the greedy regional countries like Saudi Arabia, and it means the story isn't over yet.
In the limelight.
While the research predicts a potentially bleak future for many marine species, the authors say it also measures how much our oceans and the life within them stand to benefit from both climate change mitigation and adaptation. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, 90% of marine species face extinction under emissions status quo, the study shows. Here's more. A new study details the disastrous consequences that would result for marine life across the world's oceans if current levels of fossil fuel emissions are maintained, with up to 90% of ocean species facing extinction. Daniel Boyce, a research scientist at Bedford Institute of Oceanography in Nova Scotia, Canada, led the study examining 35,000 species of marine flora and fauna, as well as bacteria and protozoans, devising a new analytical tool called the Climate Risk Index for Biodiversity. Under the current level of emissions, which the United Nations said in 2019 were on track to raise global temperature by 3 to 5 degrees Celsius, nearly 90% of marine species would be at high to critical risk of being wiped out, and 85% of those species' native habitats would be affected on average. Boyce told ABC News, "It is the worst-case scenario. And when we evaluated that scenario, we found that there was a very grim picture for the climate risk for marine species." Boyce wrote at Carbon Brief recently that major predator species, including sharks and tuna, were found to have a significantly higher risk that species further down the food chain, such as forage fishes and invertebrates, as these apex species can exert a disproportionate influence on ecosystems. It further suggests that ecosystem structure and functioning will be affected, wrote Boyce, whose research was published in Nature Climate Change. The study also shows how the climate crisis is exacerbating global inequality, with people in the global south expected to face major direct impacts of the widespread extinction of marine species. Climate risk is largest in coastal ecosystems that support the highest fishery catches, and in many subtropical and tropical ecosystems that tend to be biodiversity hotspots, said Boyce, identifying coastal areas in South America, Central America, and South Asia as some of the places that will see the sharpest declines in marine life under the status quo. This then represents yet another example of climate inequality, he added,